He's visiting me, he's in the audience. He's visiting me from Pennsylvania, and I was just talking to him, saying that it's like Pennsylvania here. So thank you all for coming. How many of you know that tonight there's a makeup talk on the Heart Sutra? How many of you do not know? Please raise your hands. You're either in for a treat or you're getting something that you're not looking for. Mysteriously, last Monday, every month, the first Monday, we have a Dharma talk. So last Monday, we were concluding on the Heart Sutra. But mysteriously, this recorder did not record anything. Instead, it recorded, I thought I had erased everything. It recorded the second talk. So it was quite strange. So hopefully we'll have this worked out. How many of you have not heard of the Heart Sutra? Please raise your hand. Okay. It's one of the main Buddhist scriptures. In the Mahayana tradition. And the uniqueness of the scripture is that it is very compact, concise, very brief, very short. And the purpose for this series of talk is so that most of the sitters that come to the sitting practice on Monday nights establish a foundation in the Buddhist theory, kind of like the Buddhist path, the purpose for meditation, purpose for practice. Once you have a theory and basic understanding and outlook, then when we practice, we will have a goal or an aim. So the Heart Sutra serves this function. It is very short, not the shortest text in the Buddhist canon. Unlike other religions, Buddhism has thousands of texts. So this is one of the shortest ones. Usually we begin with reading the Heart Sutra together. But because last week was the last, supposedly the last talk, the text that I had Xerox for everyone is put away. It's no longer there. So tonight you can just listen to me recite the Heart Sutra for all of you. Avalokiteshvara was coursing the deep Prajna Paramita. He perceived that all five skandhas are empty, thereby transcending all sufferings. Sariputra, form is not other than emptiness, and emptiness not other than form. Form is precisely emptiness, and emptiness precisely form. So also are sensation, perception, volition, and consciousness. Sariputra, this voidness of all dharmas is not born, not destroyed, not impure, not pure, does not increase or decrease. In voidness there is no form, and no sensation, perception, volition, or consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought. There is no realm of the eye, all the way up to no realm of mental cognition. There is no ignorance, There is no ending of ignorance, through to no aging and death, and no ending of aging and death. There is no suffering, no cause of suffering, no cessation of suffering, and no path. There is no wisdom or any attainment, with nothing to attain. Bodhisattvas relying on Prajna Paramita attain Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. Therefore know that Prajna Paramita is the great mantra of power, the great mantra of wisdom, the supreme mantra, the unequaled mantra which is able to remove all sufferings. It is real and not false. Therefore recite the mantra of Prajna Paramita. Gate, gate, hara gate, hara sam gate, bodhisvaha. That was pretty short, right? Now I'm all nervous whether this will record or not. Just check. The shortest Buddhist text is actually just one syllable. Just bliss, bliss from liberation. Indeed, that's the purpose of the Buddhist practice, liberation. Liberation from what? Anyone? Suffering. That's the key. In order to be free from suffering, we must first understand suffering. Causes of suffering, you know, how it accumulates, how it perpetuates. And understand whether there is an end to suffering, whether it's possible to end suffering. Because if it's not possible, then there's no need to practice. There's no need to put yourself in a pretzel shape, in a leg position, and go through meditation with pain. So indeed, if there's an end to suffering, there must be a process through which the causes of suffering is destroyed or untangled, unraveled. So this is actually the Four Noble Truths. Right? Arguably the core teaching of the Buddhist tradition. Now, Buddhism has many different schools, many different texts, and this is something that all Buddhists agree on, the Four Noble Truths. But in my recitation just now, it says there's no suffering, no cause of suffering, no cessation of suffering, no path. Not only that, there's no birth, no death, there's no constituents of what is understood as a human being from the Buddhist perspective, the five skandhas. Right, so from an ordinary perspective, we understand human being as constituted by body and mind. In Buddhism, we divide into five different, one division is the five different parts. Instead of a dualistic part, we have a five-part kind of construction. Form, material form, right, referring to the body, and the process of what is known as the mind, sensation. These are five fundamental, kind of rudimentary functions of the mind, you may call it. Sensation, perception. Sensation could be pleasurable, unpleasurable, and neutral. These are the only three sensations that we could possibly have in each moment. Each moment, that's the key word, because we could have pleasant and unpleasant situation we feel at the same time, but it's just moment to moment change. Okay. So each instant could have possibly three different types of sensations on a very elementary level. That's not where the cause of suffering comes from. perception. That's not where the cause of suffering comes from either. In Buddhism, perception sometimes translated as cognition. It refers to the discriminatory faculty, our ability to discern pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Our ability to categorize, compartmentalize all of our experiences, all the world around us and ourselves. Beautiful, ugly, pleasant, unpleasant, nice, not so nice, black, white, red and yellow. All the different labels, symbols that we use. This is the discriminatory faculty. Third one, category of mind, is mental formation. Sometimes it's translated as volition. This is where things start to be interesting. Once we experience something that's pleasant, unpleasant, we have a label for it. Then without awareness, almost on automatic pilot, we generate action, either of the body, speech, or mind. The mind, for example, seeing something very nice, categorize. This is a nice, handsome young boy. I'm sorry, young man. Right? And seeing him, oh, it's friendly. I want to be friends. I like. That thought of categorizing, which is itself not a problem, but after I categorize, I generate feeling of liking. Like wanting to be friends. Whereas someone else I see wearing that jersey. I don't like Florida State, for example. I'm from Gainesville or whatever, right? I see that. Jersey, it's not much, I don't care so much about jersey, black, any color. But the words I cognize as Florida State, now that has meaning to me. Based on my categorizations, I generate volition. So something I like, I don't like. That is volition, natural function of mind. Now, we go through our lives every day, each and every moment, experience the world this way, and ourselves this way. And our liking and dislikes, likes and dislikes, fortunately or unfortunately, are perpetuated from moment to moment. Things that we gravitate to, we want more. Things that we don't like, we want to get rid of. And this basic mechanism of liking, disliking, becomes the way that we are wired, almost. So everything in the world is filtered through our own lens of liking, disliking. Right? Which leaves, and all of these little decisions that we make leave repercussions, lasting impressions, and that is consciousness. So we have form, sensation, perception, volition, consciousness. Consciousness has two functions on a very basic elementary level in the Buddhist sense. In one sense, it refers to our ordinary usage of consciousness. Meaning, we're conscious that we have sensations, we're conscious that we have perception and volition. We're aware. It's a kind of cognitive awareness that's present. And it's present even when we sleep. Because when you have dreams, for example, of something terrible, you can sweat, you can perspire. You can generate fear, all of this by mind's own objects. So ordinarily, the example that I give is I see something nice, I see something not nice, and I generate this kind of volition. We don't have to use the eye faculty, because part of this makes up who we are in the faculty of in the aggregate or skanda of form is not only eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. In the Buddhist from the Buddhist perspective, mind is part material, part immaterial. So the material part is the brain. Right? Even all the other senses lie dormant in dream. The faculty of mind as part of form can generate mental objects and respond to the objects. The same five skandhas are put into operation. You see? So this is the scary thing about it is moment to moment we're engaging the world like this and we're perpetuating what we like and what we don't like. It happens so subtly. So consciousness, one aspect of it is it facilitates the experience of the previous four skandhas, particularly the previous three, right? Sensation, perception, volition. The other function of it serves as a container, repertoire, a kind of, I often, my students at FSU who have taken class with me will know this. I give the analogy of the Santa Claus bag. It's like an empty bag, except it's not empty. It's filled with all of our impressions, mechanisms, patterns of behavior, all the volitions that we have made, right, that we have perpetuated. It leaves an imprint. There's a repercussion to it. So that generates a sense of habitual tendency, habit. We tend to like this type of person, we tend to dislike that type of person. We tend to like this food, and not like that kind of food. We have our own preferences. But these leave impressions in the mind. It's not that there's a real Santa Claus bag holding all of these impressions. It's just an analogy, in a way, of saying that we give it a name, a label for this aspect of the mind. And this function. So this is the five skandhas. What I have said is basically a review of what of the previous talks. And the reason that the Harshasha says that they're empty is because each of these aggregates, conditions, in themselves, there's no inherent, permanent, independent, separate existence. Everything is interrelated. Everything. Our faculty of eye able to see because we have an eyeball, our retina works, and there's an object that we can perceive. And not only that, we have a mind. Consciousness facilitates this. So it's like a tripod. Sense faculty, sense objects, and moment-to-moment cognitive awarenesses. Lacking one, the other two cannot exist. Right? It's like, for example, a person just passed away, corpse, lying there. There's eye, still pretty fresh. Eye faculty. There's objects, can't see. Consciousness is there. Or consciousness there, but my faculty is something wrong with it. I wear glasses, So if I take it off, I don't see clearly. And if I make a judgment, that discriminating faculty based on a faulty faculty, what do you think my decisions will be like? Very limited. Maybe wrong. Right? From the Buddhist perspective, all of our faculties are limited. Even if you have 20/20 eyesight, your nose is as keen as a German Shepherd, you know, it's limited. Because it's limited, and it operates on the basis of a self-referential baggage of collected, patterned, fixed, rigid way of seeing things is limited. Me growing up in New Jersey, New York area will have a certain type of experience. In a certain home will have a certain type of experience. Even two people in the same home will have two different experiences. So faculty cannot exist. For all experiences, depending on faculties, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, corresponding objects, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought, as objects. And moment to moment, cognitive awareness, which is shaped by the Santa Claus bag, whatever content do you have in there. So a person who is always seeing everyone is trying to, this person is having a conspiracy theory of everyone is trying to get him, right? Always victimizes himself. Then the faculties, all right, relatively speaking, and the objects is there, we're all looking at the same thing, but the way I'm experiencing it will be very different. You see? So everything's interdependent. Everything cannot exist separately. Everything is impermanent. Impermanence. That's the key too. So spatially, everything is kind of interdependent. Eye, faculty, moment to moment, cognitive awarenesses. Temporally, everything changes. Imagine you had the same mentality as you had since you were 2 years old. That wouldn't be too good, right? Maybe to some people it would be a bliss, right? But it would certainly be limited. And putting aside 2 years old, even our thoughts yesterday or the previous moment, we change our minds all the time. After this talk, your opinion on certain things will be different. Your understanding will shift a little bit. Next time you hear someone talking about faculty of seeing and then the object, and you think about, you know, this kind of interdependence, this interplay of kind of interdependent experiences that we have. So for that reason, the five skandhas are empty. Interdependent, constant changing. It's like this nice cushion in front of me. This cushion, this fabric, maybe 100% cotton. It comes from the cotton field. Cotton field, in order to grow, comes from trees, soil, rain, the sun, the cotton family, factory, I mean. Maybe the factory is run by a family. You know, making it, weaving it, and there's a dye, blue dye. All of these factors come together, just like the five skandhas: form, sensation, perception, volition, consciousness, us. Come together, and then we have this thing. This thing is constantly changing. The more people use this cushion, it'll wear down. Like my cushion that I use, my home. I've had it for maybe 20 years. And it's been broken so many times that I keep on sewing it, right? But it's such a thin layer. One time after I sewed it, I felt it was pretty good. As soon as I sat down, it kind of ripped again. So I thought about one thing. I put another sheet of fabric underneath it. Then I sew it back. It doesn't rip. So things are impermanent. That's easy to understand. But the way we operate in our daily life, we behave exactly the same, exactly exact opposite of impermanence and interdependent way. Our decisions, judgments, are made on the basis of permanence. Right? And things are solid, discrete entities outside us, separate. You're out there, I'm over here. So, in other words, we're acting contrary to how things actually are. How things actually are. So our mode of existence is based on something that's not real. At least not real in the sense that how things actually operate. Last week I talked about a friend of mine, got his PhD from the same school, we're in the same class. In his talk he was saying, at graduation, saying, I worked so hard. Basically the message is, everything that he has done is through his own effort and hard work. It's just ridiculous. His knowledge, the books that he has read for his PhD dissertation, the previous scholarship, his colleagues, everything has contributed to his understanding. See? No, my opinion is mine. Your opinion is formed on the basis of earlier opinions and judgments and experiences, which is related to everyone else. So then, no, the body is mine then. The body is not yours either. The body is the food that you eat, the liquids that you drink, right? The interactions that you have with the world. Always interconnected. So which part of it is actually me, mine? That's the Buddhist quest. To understand, what is that? Who am I? But because the way we act, based on kind of self-referential way, if you examine your decisions and the way you operate, even meeting a new person, seeing a new things, how you're making judgments, well, this is cool, not cool, it's good, not good, it's always self-referential, based on your experiences, your knowledge, and your opinion. So every act is based on something that's permanent, and the first permanent thing is I, me. I'm permanent, and you're out there. You're separate from me. Right? The Buddhist wisdom, which is the aim of the Heart Sutra, is to deconstruct this false assumption. That's what it really comes down to. It's an assumption that there's something permanent called I. It's to deconstruct that by showing you from different perspectives how that is not true. What you assume to be you, come from your parents, your friends, the books you've read, the interactions you've made, accumulated experiences leading to habitual tendencies, patterns of thinking, all this, all related, interrelated. To show that the constructedness of this, what we think as reality. Why does Buddhist text, scriptures, the great practitioners focus on this? Because its diagnosis of suffering and the cause of suffering comes from this assumption. Self. Self-grasping. That's the bottom line. Self is not inherently bad. We need it in order to build character, to live an ethical life, to live a life that's helpful to all people around us. So inherently it's not a problem. But the problem is the assumption that it's permanent, independent, separate entity. That's the problem, the assumption. So in other words, it's not the object, it's the grasping hand that's holding it, that's making the problem. The object, this stick comes from tree, rubber, everything else. It's the assumption based, this is real, this is mine, therefore I want it. You can't have it. Right? Or this is not mine, but I have an interest in it, so I'm going to make it mine. Right? Like individual to other individuals, or nation to another nation, or one political party to another political party. Right? The assumptions, I have a vested interest in it, so I want more of it. Right? And that assumption is based on this thing is real, it's permanent, separate, and it's most importantly, it's better. Right. In other words, it's better than what I have now. It's better than this. Turn it around. I want this to be other than what it is, whatever this may be. If you think back about times that you have suffered, felt anguish, pain, at the heart of that is, I want this moment to be other than what it is. Why? Because you have an assumption of this is bad, that's good. There's already a model working. There's something better, and this is not good. Good and bad are labels, perception, constructs. Okay? So, and why is it good and bad? Because it's good and bad for me. So self lies in the center of all of our judgments. This is not something like you have to believe. This is something that you can see, that you have to kind of examine. So in this sense, Buddhism very much value our own intellect. There's no doctrine to believe. There are teachings. Teachings, if you don't gravitate to one teaching, don't use it. If you think it's true, if you think it's working for you, use it. How do you know it's working for you? Not because some teacher say it. That would be blind faith. You examine it in your own life. Right? Your interaction with the world. So, now we come to the heart of the matter itself. Sense of permanence, separate, independent, as opposed to kind of interdependent. Right? So we know this conceptually, but we don't enact upon it on a very on a visceral level, on a gut level, emotive, emotional level, we don't behave like that. That's the cause of suffering. Is it possible to remove it? Of course. How? Because our natural mode of existence, the way we actually operate, is interdependent, free, change. That is the wonderful thing. Because of change, we can grow. Because of change, we can learn new things. Because we're interdependent, therefore we can grow. We can absorb new ideas. So guagu is made up of non-guagu. And that's a wonderful thing. Thank goodness. If guagu is some kind of separate, then guagu is mine. That'd be a horrible way of life. Likewise, all of you. Fran is made up of non-Fran. Brian is made up of non-Brian. So operating, living our lives in this way, receptive, open, recognizing the value of different things, then we can live a better life, peaceful, more dynamic. Right? Imagine going to a board meeting, thinking that your opinion is the best. You have a terrible time there. You cause other people suffering, and you're the first one who experiences suffering. Getting tense when someone's opinion is different than yours. So you're the first one who's experiencing suffering, even without you saying it. Different opinion, why? Because mine's better. Or this way of seeing. But if you can see different things from different angles, not buying to this mechanism of grasping onto, yeah, this view is the best. There are good views, there are bad views, on different occasions, at different times. There's not one perfect way to do things. Sometimes, not so good way, it's perfect, the best way, at another time. You see? So that shows that it's not necessarily the best way. So your opinion, your judgments, you're more open now. So that is practice. Not necessarily sitting in a lotus pretzel shape every day. So you're able to use, that's why theory and practice must always go together. That's why we're having this talk. Without theory and understanding, a new understanding of seeing things, then we just perpetuate our old self-grasping. And that we call spiritual materialism. Right? Before we got into Buddhism, we're into, you know, Gucci bags, you know, Corvettes, well, maybe not Corvettes. Now people are into like better 80s, I'm still thinking. Corvettes. Now it's more like
Prius.
Oh, Prius. Or those hybrid cars. Oh, look at me, I'm environmentally friendly. Look at those people driving a Hummus. Bad. And me. So anything, you could be, I mean, I'm not saying environmentally friendly is bad, I'm saying anything can be turned around to perpetuate your self-grasping, your views that you hold. So a very humble person can have a very strong sense of self. So Buddhism's wisdom of no self, it doesn't mean that a person like, let everyone step over you, I have no self, I have no view anymore. No. So, spiritual materialism is where you don't have any view, or worse, you have your own view when you meditate. So, you meditate good, you want to perpetuate it. This period is not good sitting, you get up and walk away. That's why we have timekeepers. When you want to walk away, you don't. And you sit there, you try to experience. You may feel that you have pain. Pain. Pain is just a label. It's made up of non-pain. It's made up of different experiences. Each moment of the experience is different. sometimes it's kind of jabbing kind of pain. Sometimes it's kind of like just numbing effect. Or sometimes just little sporadic kind of charge of energy. It's like, you know, that kind of thing. So it's quite interesting. So if you just relax, natural, and clear, you can actually experience, the label falls away, and you just experience moment-to-moment experience. And you forgot that, oh, actually it's me who's having the pain. Me, this I removed. It's just pain. Then once the blockage is, the energy blockage is kind of penetrated, then it's just refreshing experience. Those of you who've gone on retreats or have other experiences will know. Sit through the pain. Not like you're in a battle, but you just open experience. And the pain too will pass. That's actually good for your body. Because the blockages trying to, your energy flow is trying to go through the blockages. Now it's gone through. So that old injury, whose muscles healed, the tendons are healed, but the blockage is there. Now that's healed too. See? So you must have some kind of foundation in understanding interconnectedness of things and the transiency of all things, impermanent and made up of everything else. Our labels are just references. It's just my label. It's to other person, they may like it. Right? They may be into pain. There's some people that's really into pain, right? So their categories are different. Their experiences will be different. So our experiences are shaped by our categories. The crux of that, center of that, is the self, the grasping to the self. So Buddhism has many ways to deconstruct that. We've gone over the five skandhas. Today I'd like to talk about Eighteen realms, 12 link chains, and 8 levels of consciousnesses. I've actually already covered the 18 realms. The first 6, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. The second set of 6, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought. The last set, cognition generated from the interaction of sense faculty and sense object. So eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, or cognitive awareness, tongue, taste, touch, and mind. Together, this formulates a more complex view of a human being. 5 skandhas is a kind of 5-fold way to chop up the pie. 18 realms is just 18 ways, a more refined way. This analysis is basically a kind of spatial analysis to show us that there's Guagu is made of non-Guagu. You are made up of everything else and everyone else. And that's why when a person realizes emptiness, not the kind of vacuity, kind of bliss that you kind of zap into when you're sitting in meditation, but a kind of dynamic wisdom of recognizing emptiness is relationships. Emptiness is connectedness, interrelatedness. That kind of wisdom is Buddhist wisdom. It's quite dynamic. Recognizing that and realizing that, personally experiencing that, that is what is called a Chan or Zen awakening. Not a conceptual one, but the actual assumption of self that I talked about actually suddenly drops away. So you actually experience the world without the filter of a self-referential point. Can you imagine that? Unimaginable. Unfathomable. Because all of our lives, we have been filtering the whole world through our own labels, experiences, ourselves. It's like for the first time, seeing things as they are. Freely, without the burden of lugging around your views, your opinions, your judgments, your ideas, your experiences, formulating who you are. I am this kind of person, that kind of person. Just suddenly drop away. That kind of freedom. Suffering ceased. Unfortunately, the self comes back because our self-grasping has been formulated, perpetuated for so long that a little tiny experience of enlightenment is not going to do it. It's not going to cut it. So you have to be enlightened again and again and again and again. One Zen master has said that after he was quite old, he said, it took 36 great enlightenments. He's counting. And numerous small enlightenments to finally put this rhinoceros to death. So, that's the ultimate goal of Buddhist practice. But we have to not only to practice sitting meditation, but integrate it in our lives. Allow it to rest in our being, to shape our experiences in a new way. Like my opinion says, not take yourself so seriously. Your own opinions, your own views and judgments, just kind of learn to see things from other people's perspectives. Even a criminal, to the criminal's mother, it's like, my child is good. Everyone has good qualities. Everyone has valid points. Everyone. I was discussing politics with my stepfather. Every political party has some valid point. If you're like only one or only the other, from the Buddhist perspective, it's just perpetuating the same old thing. Except this is not spiritualism. In practice of meditation, that's spiritual materialism. It's just, there are good things and good perspective in different times, in different occasions. So to free ourselves from views, grasping to views. Then we become unplugged from the matrix. Then you're like Neo. You don't have to block bullets. It's just bullets come and go. Oh. And the bullets is falling around. You know? Why? Because you understand that this world is constructed. It's fabrication. Collectively and individually. Collectively contributing to this matrix, the world. Everyone's in on it. It doesn't matter what a humble person, a greedy person, everyone is in on it. So being unplugged, you're no longer part of this, the matrix of what the Buddhists call samsara, the mechanism of suffering. Just perpetuates itself, and everyone's plugged in. This pie of Dharma could be divided 5 ways, 18 ways. It's the same. It's to show that nothing's permanent, everything is interdependent. It can also be chopped up 12 ways, and that's a temporal view. The spatial view is 5 skandhas and 18 realms, which is in the Heart Sutra. That's why I'm talking about it. Right? It talks about there's no realm of the eye, all the way up to no realm of mental cognition. Right? Emptiness. That's referring to the 18 realms. Right? There's no ignorance. There's no ending of ignorance. No aging and death. Right? What is that? 12-fold lynching. Everything begins with ignorance, not low intelligence. Buddhism teaches that ignorance refers to not being able to see things as they are. See things filtered through self-grasping. That's ignorance. So a very intelligent person, a philosopher, that teaches about existence and all that, they could be very ignorant. Right? Practitioners who are eloquent in talking, have deep experiences, they could be ignorant. Right? Why? Because the self-grasping is almost wired in, ingrained. And Buddhism has a very long view, past, present, and future. And past refers to previous lives, present, this life, and numerous future lives, such that our grasping of self-attachment, self-cherishing ideas, self-importance, it doesn't come from this life. It comes from just mechanisms, patterns. The most subtlest mental continuum that continues from one lifetime to the next. What is that mental continuum? That's the Santa Claus bag I'm talking about. Buddhism does not believe there's a permanent sense of soul. Going from one lifetime to the next, like changing clothes, new clothes every lifetime. No. Nothing is permanent. But something is transpiring from one to the other. What is that? That Santa Claus bag and all of its content. That repercussion, tendency, that force, mechanism that we ourselves have deposited. No one else is kind of governing our lives. All of our tendencies continue on a very subtle level. When I get to the 8 layers of consciousness, I'll talk about that. But returning to the 12, ignorance. Next is action, which is unavoidable. Action of the body, speech, and mind. Constantly we're doing it. Leads to consciousness, the third link chain. These three constitute the past lives. Consciousness is what, at this point, consciousness refers to the most subtle level of consciousness, the mental continuum, most subtle level that transpires from one lifetime to the next. The next seven, from 4 to 10, that's the present life. The fourth link chain is name and form. In other words, body and mind, or fetus. Like the very moment of, the first moment of consciousness transpire to this fetus. From that, because you have name and form consciousness, then inevitably you will have what is called the 6 entries, the 6 sense faculties. Things come in. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. From 6 sense faculties, inevitably we will have sensation, or rather contact. Contact with the world, with sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought. From contact, next link chain, sensation. Autopilot, this is automatic. Right? Sensation, pleasurable, unpleasurable, neutral. Once we have sensation, then we will have desire or craving. Craving for pleasurable, this is instinctual, it's kind of animal instinct. Instinctual to living beings, even ants. Right? Ants coming this way, you tap it on the ground, it kind of gets scared and goes the other way. Why? Fear. Or kind of danger, go the other way. Unpleasant, in other words. So you'll have grasping, craving. Craving for what? Pleasant. Get rid of what? Unpleasant. So built into this craving, there is aversion. That's why in Buddhism, the three poisons of the mind, ignorance, greed, hatred. Ignorance is too hard to see. It's like an eye cannot see itself, unless you're standing in front of a mirror. In ancient India, they use kind of different surfaces. That may not be a good analogy to see one's own reflection. But generally speaking, eye cannot see itself. This is the way we operate. We're wired. I'm not talking about low intelligence. Again, ignorance means we don't see things the way they actually are. We see things through greed and aversion, liking, disliking, based on what? Sense of self. In the center of all of our experiences, self-referential. So embedded, inherent in the craving is something I don't want, aversion. Once you have craving and aversion, then you have grasping, the next link chain. Grasp what? Grasp what you like and get rid of what you don't like. And that's the culprit, this particular link chain. You can't say, now Buddhist practice is not that, okay, so that's the culprit in the 12 link chain. Well, let me finish the link chain. So once you have grasping, then of course you have existence, right? If I grasp on something, then that thing exists for me. Like I'm holding on this cup now, it exists for me. Then there's duality. There's out there, something out there, and me who's grasping. Subject, object, conflict, duality. Once there's existence, the next link chain is existence of what? Congratulations, your future birth. You've just almost completed the cycle of this samsaric process. Your future birth, inevitably it will lead to kind of this momentum will propel you into future birth. Your tendency, your grasping this, rejecting that. And once you have birth, then you have the last link chain, old age and death. This is the 12th link chain. So the culprit is what? Like I said, craving, right? Grasping, these two. So you can't say, okay, after contact, then I have sensation. Then I just stay neutral all the time. Then I will be saved. It doesn't work that way. That would be a wrong practice. A long time ago, there was this great, hard-working practitioner, Zen practitioner, quite famous in town, and this wealthy patron built a whole hut for this person to practice. You know, bring food to him, he can be isolated, he can practice meditation, read whatever text you want, support him. One time, the old lady, the patron, wondering how he's doing. It's been several years, you know, practicing by himself, supporting a great practitioner. So she sent her daughter, beautiful, attractive, young, fresh, and dressed in a very sexy garment, right? I'm adding that little bit to dramatize the story. So he says, okay, today you serve food to him and hug him, hold on to him, and ask him how he feels. Here comes the drama, right? So not only he serves the food, and he's a great, great practitioner. She just, you know, I'm dramatizing again, of course. Lowers one shoulder, you know, bare, and then hugs the monk. Now the monks just allow the girl to hug him and turns to the girl and says, "Cold ash, dry mountain, like a withered log leaning on this precipitous hill." And the young lady was like, "Oh, great practice." Goes back and reported to the mother. The mother says, "He said that?" Got out her broom, went to the hut, chased the monk out. "I've been supporting you all these years, and this is your attainment?" And then burned down the hut. That's like the 12 lynchings. If I have no sensation, then I must be liberated. No, not liberation. This is just zombie. It'll be quicker if I just smack you over the head with a hammer, and you'll be in a coma. Much quicker. Cheaper. It's quicker, cheaper, you know, doesn't cause anyone else problems, and most importantly, you'll be liberated. If that was the case, then you can all line up here. Here, I have the stick. It's not a hammer, but I think it'll do the trick if I hit hard enough. Right? No. Then Buddhist practice would not. That kind of wisdom, that kind of behavior, no wisdom at all. Therefore, no compassion. True wisdom of emptiness is not, "You're empty, therefore non-attached," or like something like that. Or, "I'm empty, therefore," it's like you leaning on me is like a cold, withered log leaning on my body. No. Wisdom of emptiness in Buddhism is quite dynamic, interrelated. So when you, another story, someone asked this great Zen master this time, "Master, how do I be free from suffering, the cause of suffering?" But of course Zen folks, they talk in their own crazy language. He says, "Master, how do you escape the cold and the heat?" This is a Chan way, Zen way of saying how do you be free from suffering, cold and heat, two extremes. Of samsara, liking, disliking, birth and death. The master says, "Oh yeah, there's a way. In cold, cold kills you. In heat, heat burns you." And the monk heard that, enlightened. He was thinking about, "Oh, if you're cold, go to a warm place. And if you're hot, go to a cold place." That's not the Buddhist way. That would be escapism. Huh? I'm too busy at work, so I meditate to bliss out. That wouldn't be Buddhist way. Buddhist way is to practice what we understand in daily life. Meditation is important to build a foundation only. It's like playing tennis. You gotta learn how to play against the wall first before you play with an Olympic champion. Otherwise you have no way to even hit back. The ball goes so fast, right over your head. Right? So this is a means. Kills you means kills you. You. Self-attachment. Take the you out of it, the self out of it, you're free. In coldness, in heat. So when you're sad, be sad. Shed tears. When you're happy, be happy. You know, say sad. Some people become sad and they want more sad. They lock themselves out. They want to absorb in their sadness. You ever see those people that are depressed? They tend to perpetuate that depression. Why? It's attracting. In depression, the sense of self-grasping, very strong. People that commit suicides, they feel worthless, no sense of self, I'm useless. Oh, the self-attachment is more stronger than ordinary people in order to go through death. That's the strength of self-attachment. The view of, I should kill myself. That view, that grasping, so powerful. See? So, it's the self-grasping.
grasping onto yourself, that's the culprit. So Buddhist practice is to understand the interdependence of this, right? And go at the core, which is ignorance. That's the Chan way. The 12 link chain, come at ignorance. Not to see things from your perspective, judging people from your way, but to always see things from different perspective, different angles. Have a more systemic, interrelated perspective view on life. An appreciation of impermanence and change. Then we will have practice, integrated Dharma practice. And once this view is totally lodged in, this understanding, your self-grasping becomes more and more diminished. You have opinions, you may have strong opinions, but you don't attach to it. Long-time practitioners, they have strong views. Their views are backed up by their own experience, Chan experience, but they're not attached to it. Even the experience of seeing self-nature, who we are, our true nature, enlightenment, they're not attached to it. If there's something to be attached to, then that's a problem. Like spiritual material, it's one more thing that you've gathered, collected, these experiences. So, talk too much. 9:08, those of you who have to leave, feel free. I'll take a few minutes to finish up. The third thing I'd like to talk about, which is 8 layers of consciousnesses. The first 6 you've already heard: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. These different layers operate on a very primitive level. Primitive meaning they're moment to moment, they don't last. Consciousness derived from eye. If I look at you, I turn around, look at someone else, that conscious moment is gone. It leaves impression only when I attach to it, when there's self-grasping, when I attach to it. Unfortunately, self-attachment is continuous, so it's always there, right? Let me explain a little bit about the 6 consciousness. The first 5 is easy to understand. Awareness that comes from eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. The 6th one, the faculty of discrimination. 2-part, material and non-material. So this 6th consciousness is the discriminating faculty. It's able to discern, categorize, compartmentalize the world that we experience. But even so, it's only a soldier, a foot soldier to the general. Who's the general? The 7th consciousness, which is a label we give to self-grasping. An aspect of mind that relate to the world in a self-referential way that's continuous, perpetuates itself, always ever present. Sure, we may not feel its presence, especially when we're just walking down the street, you know, not particularly doing anything. But as soon as the self is threatened, challenged, like someone step on your foot, or you know, you're walking by this way and someone turns around and spits on the ground, but you just happen to walk by. Then your self will come out right away, right? So it's not that self is kind of sometimes exists, sometimes doesn't exist. It's continuous. So that's the 7th consciousness. The 8th one is the repository. It is that which transmigrates, transpires from one lifetime to the next. And that is none other than the Santa Claus bag. The baggage of karmic seeds, karmic potentials, imprints that we've left in our mental continuum. When a person dies, the first sense six dissolves right away. And the seventh one absorbed right into the eighth and continues. Now this is a metaphor, as if something is kind of actually continuing. Right? Whereas what we're talking about here is really the subtlest level of continuum, energy. This energy is specifically shaped by your acts. That's why one karmic stream is different than someone else's. That's why, you know, people born in the same family, same mother, same father, they have different personalities, they have different lives, different fate. So that's the eight layers. That's another way to cut up the pie. But even however which way we cut it up, none of them are permanent. None of them. And the reason for these teachings, five way, eightfold way, 12, 18, is just to point out one thing. And that is, we are originally free. And we have potential, because that we're free, to be enlightened, to realize that we're free. So Buddhist enlightenment is not like realizing something outside yourself. From the Buddhist perspective, anything that you realize outside yourself can be lost. It's just another samsaric element. It's realizing how things actually exist in yourself and others. So for a person who realizes that, he or she realizes connectedness, relationships, openness. And that's why wisdom and compassion are like two wings of a bird, because they're the same actual thing. It's the same realization. It's not that you become suddenly, like a pushover or a very kind person that always has a smile, everything bad happens, I'm smiling. No. You realize who you are. The karmic baggage, the Santa Claus bag, still persists. That's why different charm masters, Zen masters, behave differently. They're just drawing from this their own resources, the karmic bag. Now the contents of the karmic bag are no longer processed by the seventh consciousness. So something like anger that you plant a seed come out, become like ferocious determination to practice, or like a particular way to train students, very disciplined way, or certain kind of behavior. But even when a master scolds at you, right, like my teacher used to do, the late Master Sheng Yan scolds at me, laughs at me, makes fun of me. You say, his karmic bag is pretty negative. No. That's what was needed in that moment, under those circumstances. So he showed me directly my self-attachment. I think I'm proud of doing something. He comes along, like one time. In a monastery, everyone loved my chanting. Right? So after I chant, everyone's silent. The master leaves the hall first. He comes in front of me. He says, "You chant pretty good." And I'm like, the arrogance, I'm like, "Thank you, master." And then I just fell right into his trap. He says, because the second sentence is, "You chant the four great vows of a bodhisattva. Vow to save sentient beings, vow to cut off vexations, vow to master approaches to practice Dharma, and vow to Buddhahood." He says, "You chant the four great vows every day. You can't even take care of your own master, and you're absent-minded." I was just like crushed to pieces. And all the Sangha, including the lay people, just watching. So his strategy for me to reveal that self-attachment is just, here you are. This is it, right there in front of your face. It's just public humiliation. Perfect. Yeah, now I don't have a master to point that out to me. My master Shen Yan passed away. Please take a flyer for the Martin Luther King talk. A new one with a footprint. So, I have someone else. My 5-year-old daughter. And I have all of you, and my students, and everyone that I come in contact with. You reveal my vexations, my shortcomings, my limitations. The reason I cannot guide all of you and make all of you just instantaneously enlightened comes from my shortcomings as a teacher, not eloquent. Speaking of which, I'm going to do an advertisement. There will be a half-day retreat, the first one that we're going to have with this group, February 6th. So please mark that date. I'll send out an email announcement. There'll be a flyer about it. And the flyer, of course, will be made by our own Danny Tuzeo. Now, at this point, it's time to realize, do I feel proud of everyone? Make all the flyers for the Tallahassee Chan group. Yeah. All of you who come to see my flyers because of me. I'm sorry to make you but I'm not as cruel as my teacher, so we'll conclude the talk tonight. So because of a bodhisattva realizes this wisdom of interdependence, then there's no fear. It's like in dream, you dream of a tiger chasing you, you'll be fearful. But after you wake up, it's just a dream. Unplugged from the matrix, and you're not afraid of things in the matrix anymore. Therefore, the bodhisattva attains Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, unexcelled, unsurpassed, supreme enlightenment. For Avalokiteshvara is perfect enlightenment, thorough. For us, who have some glimpse, for all of us who have some glimpse of practice and realization and some inkling of this teaching, we have to have these small awakenings again and again and again and again. Chan have particular methods. The foundational one is working with the breath. But there are two distinct ones that the tradition I belong to teaches. And I'll introduce that in the retreat. Any questions? Yes.
I'm still trying to figure out how you can have strong opinions and not be attached to them.
Very easy. Our opinions come from our accumulated experience, right? Our knowledge.
Yes.
Under certain circumstances, this thing's based on my judgment, that's the best thing to do under those circumstances. But if other people do not agree to it, that's okay. That's all that means. As opposed to, no, you have to agree with me. Because this is right. This is the correct way. And because I'm experienced, I have more experience. Trust me, please, this is the best way. You realize that the workings of causes and conditions are not ripe yet, so that the group is not ready to take on that view, that perspective. And that is the condition of that group. I remember one time I was sweeping, novice monk. And I see everyone else sweeping in the courtyard in Taiwan, the main monastery. People really don't know how to sweep. You know, they're not systematic. They kind of piling different things. Why don't you just have different piles, and at the end, pile them together? So I'm like getting frustrated, a lot of vexation just by sweeping. And I go to being an idiot and being so close to my teacher as his attendant. Of course, it's very easy access, 24/7. I go to him, Shifu, these people, he says, give me half an hour and I'll take care of the whole court for you. The whole group, it takes 2 hours to do the sweeping. He says, because we have to do it as a group. That's the Chan way. I said, but I can do it very quickly, more efficient, right? 21st century. At that time was 20th century. Efficiency, we privilege efficiency, right? He says, no, that's your way to do it. That's Guo Gu's way to do it. Guo Gu's way doesn't work for everyone else. So I said, all right. It's another one of those Buddhist teachings that he's giving me. So I learned. It may be frustrating for someone who's like very strong view, but causes and conditions. Things happen because of causes and conditions. Things disperse because of causes and conditions. Just like you can't force your view down another person's throat when that person's not ready. Only when that person's ready, you just say something. Just point in the way. You get it. Transform. That's the skill of Chan masters. Doesn't blabber on all these views to you. It gets you to ask him questions. Then you're ready. Then he says something, transform. That's the skill. And if you don't have a question, the Chan master will create problems for you. Will create questions for you. So your angst, your self emerges, challenged. Right? Don't think monastic life is all peaceful, everyone meditates, and I just sweep in the Zen garden and everything. It's a lot of vexation going on. And the Zen master creates them. Right? And then, like a mirror, show you exactly where you stand in your practice. Any other question? Something to, whatever you can take from a talk, play with it, think about it, observe it, try it out. Thank you. Next Monday we have a